Hello, and welcome to Season 3 of Medical Women Talking. I'm Jane Dacre, and in this season, I wanted to speak to more wonderful and inspiring medical women, including people who are early and mid-career. These women are all making a name for themselves in their respective fields. They're what I like to call rising stars and will be influencing all our futures.
So today I'm talking to Henrietta Hughes. So Henrietta is a GP by background and she's going to tell you about her career and also, I hope, about how she's managed such an extraordinary portfolio. So Henrietta, welcome and thank you very much for coming. So can we start off by just talking about you and your career as a doctor?
Well, thank you so much for inviting me onto this podcast, Jane. And my career as a doctor started when I was very young. I had a lot of doctors in my family. And when I was two, my grandfather, who was a surgeon, made a surgeon suit for me. And it had that smell of the carbolic kind of theatre drapes that I don't know if people remember, probably those of a certain age. But that was it for me. I was a dead set on this path. And so three of my grandparents were doctors, my uncle and aunt, and my sister as well. So there's quite a lot of us in the family. And I went to Oxford. I was at Christ Church, where I did my first 3 years. And then I moved to Barts, which was a very different experience. I'd been at a boys' boarding school, so I'd had quite a lot of experience of different cultures, I would say. And at Christ Church, I was one of the earliest women there. We're known as the pioneers from the 80s, which makes me feel very old.
Well, I don't know. Being a pioneer in about women only in the 80s says something, doesn't it?
And I had I'd done quite a lot of research as a medical student in endocrinology, in gastroenterology, and also in the field of infertility. And when I was at Oxford, I had the opportunity to go to Chicago for a summer and work in an IVF unit there in basic research. And I managed to swing it so that I used that summer as the dissertation for my degree, much to my tutor's chagrin, I would say. And then when I started at Barts, because I was quite young when I started medical school, I was only 17, I felt that I owed myself a year out or a year back. And so I asked the registrar, the academic registrar and the subdean at Barts, if I could have a year out. No one had ever done that before, but I saw a lot of people going off and having intercalated degrees. I already had a degree, so I could see that the principle was established. And so they agreed to it. And I went back to Chicago for 3 months and was on an attachment in the IVF unit at the same hospital. And then I went to Jamaica for 3 months, where I worked in a village, which was quite a remote village, and did a whole range of different things, including a week of dentistry, where at the beginning of the week I was writing the patient's names down on a list. And by the end of the week, I was actually extracting molars. So it was quite a rapid sort of progress. And then I also spent time at Kingston Public Hospital as the wounds officer. So I was sewing up people, you know, who had quite severe sort of injuries, particularly those from the gun prison who were handcuffed to the chair. So it was quite a experience. And really, I saw the sort of two ends of the spectrum in terms of access to health and the sort of experience of patients from the States and from Jamaica. And then when I came back to England, I did my elective in London. That was at the IVF unit at the Hammersmith Hospital with Lord Winston. And so when I qualified and had a real sort of burning desire to do women's health and IVF, I then, after my house jobs, went to the Hammersmith and did a rotation between that and a district general hospital, and spent 2 years as a clinical research fellow doing IVF, doing basic cell research. And then that's when life threw a curveball.
Okay. I'm really interested in hearing about the curveball. But before hearing about the curveball, one of the things that I'm just listening to and listening to what you say is that actually right at the beginning of your career, there was something about you that meant you wanted to do different things, that you haven't followed the sort of direct path that, for example, I suspect most of the boys in your medical school did. You've had taken different options along the way. So it's just an interesting observation.
Well, I suppose my kind of approach is, you know, it's that sort of seek forgiveness, not permission. And you know, things should be allowed unless they're not allowed. Just because no one had ever done that before in terms of, you know, spending time abroad for their dissertation at Oxford or going off on a year out in the middle of medical school. It didn't mean that it should never happen. So I suppose that's probably something that characterises me, which is that I'm quite happy to be quite bold and push the envelope. I mean, one of the things I would say, you know, talking about the sort of experience of women is that when I was on my year out, I got a B in orthopedics. And I think that says something about how, as women, we were noticed or not noticed. You know, they probably seemed to think that I was fine because I wasn't problematic. I was
just one of the group of girls. And what, you mean you weren't even there?
No, I was in Jamaica at the time.
And they hadn't even seen you.
They hadn't noticed that I wasn't there. And I was quite pleased that I got a B, you know, because C was a pass mark.
Very good, very good. Now, sorry, to bring you back to what you were saying, I interrupted you rudely. How about, do you mind telling us about your curveball?
Well, the curveball was that, you know, I had a career all planned out. And then I met my husband, and he was in the army at the time. And we decided that if we didn't like each other very much, we could have carried on with our own career paths, because, you know, he was about to go to Staff College, which was in the Southwest. And, you know, I would have been on a rotation as a registrar, which would have taken me from here, there and everywhere. So we looked carefully at what the rotations were and also on where we could possibly live to even ever see each other. And I ended up going and doing a job in Oxford, which was very eye-opening for me in terms of some of the cultures in obstetrics and gynaecology. And I was teaching on the DRCOG course at the time, and bumped into a friend from school who was a GP trainee. And she said to me, oh, you should be a GP. It's fantastic. This is how you do it. And I thought to myself, well, it seems like a good plan, because then I can work flexibly. I can work geographically flexibly, you know, to where my husband is working. And you know, I then managed to use part of my training was from my previous obstetrics and gynecology. And then I got some other jobs in A&E and in sexual health. So everything below the waist, basically. And then I'd already organized a job for my GP registrar year. I'd approached a practice near where I lived, and they said to me, well, we normally advertise 3 months before the job starts, and you're asking for a job in 2 years' time. So we'll let you know when we advertise, but, you know, we don't normally advertise it until 3 months before the job starts. And then about 2 weeks later, they got in touch to say, well, we're going to be advertising the job for 2 years' time, just so that you know, you can have a look in the BMJ. So I applied for the job, and having that sort of you know, in the bag meant that it was a lot easier for me to get those intervening jobs as a senior house officer to complete the necessary training as a GP. And I had the massive privilege of having Iona Heath as my trainer, and you know, so inspirational in terms of what being a GP is all about. And the first thing I had to do was read the book A Fortunate Man, which has very much shaped the approach that I have in clinical practice.
So presumably pre-MMC and all of that, so one of the things that people lament about training these days is the lack of flexibility, possibly particularly the women, whereas what you're describing is how an articulate and able doctor could then design their own training program, which now we can't do. So it's interesting, isn't it?
Yeah. I don't think what I did was the sort of traditional way. And, you know, I had to do a lot of learning in terms of the areas that I hadn't worked in terms of pediatrics, psychiatry, you know, geriatrics, all of these other specialties, which are so vital to being a GP. And so it just meant that I had a lot more that I had to learn. But certainly the experience in women's health and also in sexual health, I don't think that can really be underestimated in terms of why it's so important, you know, to have those skills in general practice. And they've really carried me through actually in a whole range of other jobs that I've done. But one of the things I wanted to mention, which again has been transformational in terms of my approach as a doctor, but also in management roles, was a course that I did at the Tavistock. And this was about the patient's narrative. And I think when I'd been a medical student and we'd learned how to take a history, it was all about being very reductive. It was all about look for the headlines, look for the news at 10 bongs, you know, don't be distracted by everything else that the person is saying. But the advantage of this course was that it was about being professionally curious and genuinely interested in every single word that a patient says. And it meant that instead of having consultations, I was able to have conversations with patients. And, you know, you unlock so much more from the consultation by listening and taking on board everything that the patient says. And we use a slide in my presentations from Sir William Osler, who, you know, a 19th century physician who said, listen carefully to your patient, they will tell you the diagnosis. And I think that's something that we don't always have the skills or the training or the time, you know, to be able to do that so effectively nowadays.
Mm. No, it is much more difficult these days because of the constraints of the system, isn't it? So you worked in primary care, but then went into management. How did that happen?
Well, I also had a real advantage, I think, when my first child was born, was that the retainer scheme, which was actually started by my grandmother, Jean Laurie, when she was the president of the Women's Medical Foundation. I remember having this rather embarrassing conversation with her when I was saying, well, Granny, I'm doing this thing called the retainer scheme, and it means that I can. And then she said, oh, yes, I brought that in. So I think one of the things I learned from that was that, you know, doing something now helps the future generations. And we benefit from the work that our previous generations in medicine have done. But we shouldn't see that we can just stop, because the more that we can do now, the better we can make it for the future generations. And so the retainer scheme allowed me to work for a day and a half a week, but also to be supported in the practice. And the practice received some funding to have me there as well. So it was a great situation. And then I had my second child, and I moved to another practice near home, because they didn't have a GP, and it was a circumstance which was a real opportunity for me. So I've always worked part-time. I've done up until, you know, a few years ago, and I was able to do a whole range of other things, including teaching, being an appraiser, and I was an associate editor on a medical journal. So some of the things that I've done are paid, some of them are not paid, but for me, it's about that sort of contribution, but also learning from lots of different environments, which all, they might not seem obvious at the time that they're valuable, but then they all become extremely valuable later on. And at the time, I decided that I was actually then going to be fully self-employed. So I worked as a locum GP, and I worked only in the term time and not in the school holidays. And that then gave me the flexibility to take on a management role as the lead appraiser for a PCT. And that's when everything just sort of snowballed, I would say.
Fantastic. So tell us about that.
So appraisal was still fairly new, and I'd been an appraiser for a few years. And then I applied to be I actually applied for one of the educational roles in the PCT and I didn't get it. And I think that's really important for people listening to know that never imagine that people who are doing interesting jobs just sail through and get everything that, you know, they apply for. Sometimes it's when you don't get the job that you apply for that the opportunities actually present themselves for the right job. And so as the lead appraiser, I was responsible for the appraisers in the PCT. Then we went through the Health and Social Care Act changes. And we realized that as the PCTs were going to come together, a little bit like CCGs coming together into ICSs, it all feels rather familiar. The opportunities for sharing good practice with our neighboring PCTs was a real, you know, needed not to be lost. So I brought together the lead appraisers from the five PCTs in North Central London. We decided that we were going to work out who did what best and then all do that so that when it came to us coming together into a cluster, the work was already done and we'd have a one way of doing it for the whole cluster. And we were so happy with what we'd done that when the job of deputy medical director came up, I was really worried that somebody would come in and destroy it all. So I thought, I'll apply for that. And then at least we can kind of hold on to the good stuff. So I applied and I got that job. And within quite a short period of time, I was then I took over the full-time role as deputy medical director. And then unfortunately, my boss became very unwell and I was asked to step up to acting medical director for the cluster. And then within a fairly short period of time, the formation of NHS England was happening. And because I was an acting medical director, I wasn't entitled to be sort of a slotted in to a medical director job. And it was only when the job became advertised publicly that I was able to apply for it. And I had this rather sort of bizarre situation. And I think it is important to remember that sometimes you can plan for things, but you can never plan for everything. And you have to let chance and serendipity just be your friends. And so we were each given 10 minutes to talk to the regional medical director so that he could essentially tell us, have you thought about going back to clinical practice? You know, so it was a bit depressing for everybody. And I had my 10-minute slot and I turned up to the building in Victoria Street to have this important 10-minute meeting. And the fire alarm had gone off and everyone was on the pavement. And I was just gutted. And I was thinking to myself, this was my 10 minutes. And then I thought, look, if you're on the pavement, he's on the pavement. So I did a quick Google images search and saw what he looked like and then went and found him. And I said, hello, I'm your 10 o'clock. And he said, let's go for a coffee. And then we went for a coffee for about an hour while the alarm was still going, you know, before everyone could go back into the building. And I think that was probably quite helpful for me in terms of actually getting the job.
Sometimes things are meant to be, obviously. So can I just, as a little aside, how old were your children at that time? And did you go back to being full time? How did that all work out?
So I started full time as the deputy medical director, mainly because I was doing the job full time. And my husband said to me, look, if you're doing the job full time, you may as well get paid for it full time. And that was when they were, I think, 9 and 7. So it was a little bit earlier than I'd originally planned to work full time. I'd sort of thought in a 2-3 years on from there. But then I said to my son, you know, my son said to me, he said, the thing is, mommy, when we're at school, we don't know what you do. So, you know, so I was able to sort of drop them at school, go straight into the office, and not more often than not, pick them up and then finish off working at home. So the teachers at school didn't actually know that I had a job at all. And that Brilliant. Was what I was, you know, responsible for. Well, 3,000 GPs. So
we should make more jobs like that, shouldn't we? We really should. The medical director role, but then actually your career really, really started to take off in quite inspirational ways. So can you sort of jump to the other things that you've been taking on?
So when I was as medical director at NHS England, we were dealing with a lot of performance cases. I mean, you know, probably 250 performance cases at any one time. And they were a combination of problems with contracts, problems with problems with performance in terms of GPs or with health. And we were dealing with a really massive criminal case at the time, which was a GP who'd been the allegations of sexual assault of his patients, you know, mothers and sisters and daughters. It was absolutely horrific. And I was concerned when I was in the cluster, I had 1,100 GPs and I pretty much knew everyone. I knew enough about every GP, but with 3,000, it really became quite a large group of people to be working with. So I wanted to make sure that if anyone had a problem, they could contact me directly. And mine was the only mobile number on the NHS England website. And it was really important to me to have that access because, you know, I had appraisers contacting me saying, I'm not sure if this is a problem, but I was like, just tell me. And they'd say, well, you know, I was doing an appraisal. And when the GP closed the appraisal website, there was porn behind it on the screen. And I was like, yeah, that is a problem. You know, and we would identify issues around doctors' health, you know, and their well-being and all sorts of other aspects, which was really helpful to be able to intervene before there was a really massive crisis. But we also had people contacting me directly, which I would describe it as whistleblowing or speaking up, students and trainees who had been, you know, put in situations in practices or had real concerns about the clinical care that they were witnessing. And, you know, a member of staff around this GP with the allegation. And so what we did was we, you know, took seriously what everyone said. We acted upon it immediately. We protected the confidentiality of the people who were speaking up. And it led to, you know, a whole series of things, including, you know, arrests and conviction of the doctor who had, convicted of sexual assault. But also, you know, as I said, supportive interventions and, you know, probity interventions and contract interventions to keep people safe. And And I think I must have been ill at home. I don't know. I think I probably had a fever. I was a bit delirious. But I heard Sir Robert Francis on the radio talking about the National Guardian role. I had a sort of bizarre light bulb moment, which I was like, that is the job for me. And I was such an unlikely candidate for this job. You know, these types of roles, usually I would say that there's a clear understanding of who the type of person that people want, you know, a sort of a dame with a name in the frame, that kind of thing. Definitely not designed for a doctor. And I was just the most unlikely person. I was Mike Richards' appraiser. And he was the chief inspector of hospitals. And I contacted him and I said, what do you think, Mike? And he was like, oh, yeah, you'd be brilliant. And so he put me in touch with Sir David Behan, who was the chief exec of the CQC at the time. And I think I talked his ear off. And then I had to go through sort of six rounds of interviews, you know, with a headhunter, with a civil servant, with a psychologist, a mock news night and a mock file on four interview. And then an extraordinary horseshoe interview with the sort of great and the good. And they asked me loads of questions. I cried in the interview. They asked me if anyone had ever let me down, who hasn't been let down? But also, at the end of the interview, they said, well, thank you very much. We'll let you know. And I said, but I'd like to ask you some questions. And they said, oh, we haven't got time for that, I'm afraid. And I said, I can't believe that you are interviewing somebody to be the National Guardian for freedom to speak up and you don't give them time to ask a question in the interview.
Oh, brave lady, I suppose. You had nothing to lose.
Well, I didn't think I'd ever get it. So I was just enjoying the experience, you know. I saw it as a real learning experience, actually, and never expected to be offered the job. That was probably the most difficult job I've ever done. And hopefully it will be the most difficult job I ever do, because it's a really hotly contested area, you know, and my role was to set up a network of Freedom to Speak Up guardians and to provide training and support to the Freedom to Speak Up guardians. But it's clear to anyone who, you know, looks in from the outside that the Freedom to Speak Up guardians are essentially the channel. the thing that really matters is how leaders foster an environment of psychological safety where people feel safe to speak up. And there are a lot of barriers to that in the NHS, you know. And when I talk about leaders, I'm not just talking about trust chairs and chief execs. I'm talking about the entire pyramid of the Department of Health, of the regulators, of the commissioners, and the impact of the press, you know, and all of these different aspects that leads organizations to be working in a culture of fear. So I think the Guardians are amazing, incredible people who've done incredible things and supported over 70,000 people to speak up while I was in post. And we saw, you know, real sort of pendulum swinging in the right direction. I think the pandemic affected it a lot. I think there was a lot of speaking up that people wanted to do. We did some pulse surveys at the beginning of the pandemic, just in terms of things like access to PPE or PPE fit or fit testing, or, you know, a whole range of other aspects around people from different communities and the experiences that they had. And I think it really helped to uncover the complexity of this area. And, you know, the other thing which I was really pleased about was that the purpose of this was to have a freedom to speak up guardian in every trust. But it was immediately clear to me that the culture of the NHS depended on the culture of all of the parts of the system. So I was really pleased when NHS England, CQC and NHS Improvement at the time all appointed freedom to speak up guardians. And we could see from the research that we did that the cultures of the national bodies was significantly worse than a lot of trusts. And I think that you know, this, it just sort of unmasked some of the unspoken reality that there was. But what I find extraordinary now is, first of all, that there are still situations, and we know from the research, you know, that there's probably about 1,000 people a year are saying that they have detriment after raising concerns or speaking up, which just defies belief from my mind, because there's so much evidence that shows that if you get the culture right, that safety follows and then the finances improve. And why would we not be genuinely interested in listening to the experiences of all staff? And there are so many examples, whether it's Lucy Letby or, you know, so many others, that it's absolutely clear that when you don't listen to your staff, that, you know, you run the risk of severe or worse harm happening to your patients and to your workforce.
So do you think that culture's changing? The diagnosis is there, isn't it?
Yeah.
But is the culture changing? Harder to judge.
I don't think it's a culture. I think this is multiple cultures. This is multiple cultures of organisations and within organisations. I think there are fantastic people doing great work. And I also think that there are barriers that still exist. And that's partly to do with the understanding and the interest of people in senior leadership positions. I mean, we set up training for all workers, for all managers, and for boards as well. And when I was on a board of South Central Ambulance Service, the chair there put freedom to speak up training into the objectives of all of the non-exec directors. And that's the type of approach that I think is needed, that everybody has to see the part that they have to play. But also, I think our minds are designed to filter out information and also to get very entrenched very quickly. So we just have to be able to maintain that flexibility of thought, to have that curiosity, you know, which is something which is often missing. People jump to the point, they jump to the you know, decision without being able to keep an open mind about things.
Yeah, and maybe being a doctor makes you more likely to hone in on having the diagnosis and solving the problem. So you did that for 5 years?
5 years, yeah.
And so now a new venture. So we're coming to the end of the time. So tell us about your exciting new role.
So when I finished as National Guardian, I was interested in doing more clinical practice and doing a range of other things. And I applied for some roles, and I got some of them, like on the Health Honours Committee with you, which is amazing. But I didn't get some. And I was asked to contact the talent team at the Department of Health, which I didn't even know existed. And they said, oh, look, this is what's coming up in the future. What might you be interested in? And I was particularly interested in the Patient Safety Commissioner role, because when I was National Guardian, people had said to me, this is great that you're doing this for the staff, but what about the patients? You know, we have a much worse situation. And so the Patient Safety Commissioner role is a new role. I'm the first person to do it. It was came from the Cumberledge Review. And my role is to promote patient safety and to promote the views and voices of patients in relation to medicines and medical devices. And you know, bringing together a new team, devising a new strategy and engaging with a really broad landscape of stakeholders, from manufacturers and pharmaceutical companies all the way through to trade bodies, you know, regulators, providers, commissioners, the Royal Colleges, staff groups, patient groups, politicians and parliamentarians, because my role is appointed by the Secretary of State, but I'm accountable to Parliament. So it's an incredible experience. And to continue as a GP as well, a little bit at the weekends, that I'm able to see things in the practice and then escalate things from what people and patients have told me right through to ministers, to officials and to Parliament is an extremely, privileged and exciting role to have.
Really excellent. So as I said, we're coming to the end of our time. Just a couple of things. So being a successful woman in medicine is more and more common these days, but often it impacts a bit on people's personal lives. Do you think that your family life has been impacted by all of the fantastic roles that you've had? So that's thing one. And then thing two is, what would you tell those women who are coming through who want to be like you?
Oh, so in terms of my family life, I mean, I think what I would say is choose your life partner wisely. You know, my husband is the most unbelievable, coach, mentor, encourager for me. Everything I've done, he's always backed me up in terms of what I'm doing and how I'm doing it. And usually kind of challenges me to be, more feisty and more kind of bold. So there's definitely something. I mean, his role is a global role. So between the two of us, we're sort of busy doing stuff all the time, but always learning from each other. And I think for my children, they're just like another crazy job title, So if you want to stay kind of grounded, there's nothing like, having a teenager taking the mickey out of you to sort of do that. So that's one of the things I would say. But when it comes to what I would say, I would say to anyone who's looking to do interesting things is to just have a go. You never know. And one of the things I learned when I was younger was that women often will say, oh, I don't think I've got the qualifications to do that job. And I've now realized that I never have the qualifications to do anything, because actually, I'm not an expert in anything, but I'm really curious and I'm always learning, and I'm always learning by doing and, make mistakes and then learn from those and build on again. Part of it is about, the skills that we learn as doctors. So for me, a lot of it is about taking a history. I take a history of the whole health system to make a diagnosis about what needs to be done. The what matters to you, that personalized, bespoke way of understanding how people tick and what really is important to them, whether that's a patient or a minister, I'll have that what matters to you conversation. And then the third thing about it is the ideas, concerns and expectations. So in general practice, we look at the physical, psychological and social, and we understand the patient's ideas, concerns and expectations. These skills translate absolutely into conversations that invite change. And those conversations can be for one person or for a whole health system. So I would say rely on the skills that you already have, and don't think that there are skills out there that you don't have that are impossible to get. Everything can be learned.
Excellent. That was lovely. It was lovely to hear from you both about your portfolio, but also actually about your pioneering spirit and being an NHS hero. So thank you so much, Henrietta, for talking to us today.
Well, thank you so much, Jane.
You've been listening to Medical Women Talking with me, Jane Dacre. If you wish to hear more conversations with medical women, then check out the other seasons of this podcast series. And thank you for listening.